Hi, I'm Clemmie Telford and it's time to get open and get honest. Each week, I interview a guest about a topic that we, as a society, often shy away from. From sex lives to salaries, life and death, religion and real bodies, no subject is off the table. Welcome to Honestly, the podcast. In this episode of Honestly, I'm joined by the wonderful Dr. Woolrich, an NHS surgical doctor and Instagrammer who was able to take time out of his busy schedule back in February to chat to me. We talk of the importance of empathy, kindness and compassion in what he does, as well as the stresses of working for the NHS. Little did either of us know what was to follow, both as a country, but also for those working on the front line in the National Health Service, as we now see ourselves in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. This is a timely episode, which I hope you enjoy. So the name of the game is to be honest, and to get you in the mood, we start with a quick fire round.
Okay.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how fun are you?
Oh, I think 9. Girlfriend would probably say 7. Let's go with that.
At least you know.
Yeah, it's still high.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how popular are you?
Oh, 5.
Sorry, it's very... I know these are quite...
No, trivial. I'm going with that. 5's good.
5's good.
Polarising.
Yeah, exactly. You don't need to be liked by everyone, do you?
Just no, but like, I want to be.
Don't we all? On a scale of 1 to 10, how rebellious are you?
Oh, now... 4, you probably used to be an 8 or a 9.
So funny. Everyone I speak to, you do definitely grow out of it, don't you?
No, there's too much fear. The older you get, there's too much fear of being too rebellious and getting into trouble because the stuff that could be ruined by getting into trouble matters too much
to
you now.
It's not bunking off school, is it? Yeah, I imagined you were right at school because you've done a job that involves you being good at school. What is your favourite colour?
Pink.
Quick, I like it. Most prized possession?
Oh, I don't know. I'm trying to, my brain is going, is it the most expensive one? Is it the thing that matters the most? I really don't know. Prized possession.
And then everyone really, is your phone?
Yeah, no, it's not, because I'm not proud of that. I think it has to be something proud of for it to be prized. Because I can replace my phone.
True.
It's like something you can't replace, right? Oh, I don't know. I refuse to answer that question.
Okay, boy, yeah. Moving on.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. It's absolutely fine.
It's too hard.
And maybe there isn't, you know, there's very few things. How would you describe your relationship with money?
Yeah, very good, actually.
Confident, I like it.
Yeah.
Do you believe in marriage?
Yes.
Is it ever okay to lie?
Ooh. The fact I haven't said no straight away means yes.
What star sign are you?
I think Aries. Don't know.
When
don't really
when you
care.
Born? No, I knew what stance you'd take on this. But
April.
Yeah, you're an Aries.
That's a ram, right?
Yeah.
It's, boom. Done it. I'm in.
Yeah, but that also means that when your head's down, you're not very good at stopping and thinking usually.
Ah, yes. Okay.
What do you want to be remembered for?
Integrity.
Ooh, that's a good answer. And that came too quickly. If you could have more of anything, what would it be?
Time.
And 3 words your inner critic or imagined worst enemy would use to describe you.
Arrogant. Privileged.
I'm smirking.
Oh, all the other ones are just some play on those two.
Versions of that.
Yeah.
The big topic today, which actually I can't lock in on, but it's broadly health or healthcare or the NHS. Or doctoring, but doctoring isn't a very good word, is it?
Doctoring's a great word.
Yeah, I just want a singular word, but
yeah, broad,
all of those things, and we'll see where we get to, and then I can name it afterwards.
Health, in quotes.
Health, yeah, yeah. I think so. So, tell us about you and your career, what you specialise in, and what motivated you to do medicine.
So, I am a surgical trainee, about to apply for registrar training in orthopaedics, so hopefully... I will actually get a job, because otherwise I'll listen back to this and be like, oh, that was
shame.
When I was so confident.
But can you keep going? Can you apply?
I can apply again the following year, but every year you wait, the harder it gets to
really
to meet the criteria, or the more points you lose for having taken more years out and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that's currently where I am. I did 6 years at Imperial College in London, and I am in my 5th year of being a doctor at the moment. 5th or 6th, one or the other. So that is a bit of an odd story. I came home and told my mum I was going to do medicine, and she said, yeah, we'll see. So to backstory to that, I'd never ever mentioned it.
Really? Just okay. Yeah, how old were you approximately when that?
16.
Okay.
Yeah, no, like right at the beginning of like trying to choose what to apply for at uni, because obviously like that was the kind of school I went to. They said, well, you go to uni. So I just had to work out what it was. And in the career book, all of the subjects I was doing in A-levels
fitted into that.
Well, yeah, it was either scientist, which I thought was boring because I thought being a scientist just meant you're in a lab and I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. I like talking to people. I didn't want to be a teacher because I was in school and I was like, if I had to teach the people that I am currently in school with, I would probably not want to do myself. So I didn't want to be a teacher. And then the other one seemed really boring. And doctor, I was like, oh, yeah, that looks interesting. I'll do that. That's not what I told the medical school interviews, because otherwise that wouldn't have worked so well. I quite like the fact that it was that way around, though, just because of the fact that I had no preconceptions about what being a doctor was going to be.
Such a huge decision, because it's going to shape so much of your life.
It didn't feel like it at the time, though. No, so that was also quite nice as well, because I was just like, oh, that looks fun. I'll apply for that. That sounds cool. No. So I just took what came, and it's ended up being really nice, because I feel like I've made the job what I enjoy it to be.
Rather than preconceived ideas.
Yeah, rather than just being like, my parents are doctors, I'm going to make lots of money, I'm going to be really like highly regarded, and all that kind of stuff of what you might think being a doctor is.
Yeah.
And you go into it and realise that you're kind of often treated like dirt and you just, you know, really don't get paid that much for the time and work and effort. Still get paid a fair enough amount, though, just to clarify, but not what you would expect necessarily.
No, that's what, as you were saying that, I was like, I really would be surprised if that's people's motivation to go into medicine is for the money.
Well, when people, if it is, then people soon,
you're gonna be
soon leave.
Sadly,
they soon leave because they realise that's not, or in this country anyway, they realise that's really not how that's going to work very well for them. But as a kid, like 16-year-olds, obviously you think about things like that, right? You think about money and you're like, which job is going to pay me well and all this kind of stuff, and which job is going to get me girls, and it's like, I'm assuming, but I literally looked at it and was like, oh, that looks really cool. I realized that there was a lot of stuff in my kind of growing up that seemed to fit with it. So like, my dad was an alcoholic, and so I'd had times when like the ambulance service would turn up at the house and I'd seen other things, and there'd been like healthcare stuff going on. My aunt was a nurse, but I didn't really know. But I realised afterwards, and just stuff like that that seemed to fit with the stuff that I enjoyed and the stuff that really interested me, but I didn't realise it. So I don't know how it ended up happening, but I'm really grateful that it did.
Now, I was going to ask you what your average week is like, but that's almost a contradiction in terms, isn't it?
My average 7 weeks. Yeah. It's a 7 week block. Well, at the moment, my shifts are split up into a few different ones. I'm either on call, which isn't from home, that would be lovely. And this is like 12 and a half hour shifts in the hospital because I work in orthopedics. So if you break your leg, for example, and turn up to A&E, after you leave A&E and get admitted to hospital, you then get seen by me. So as the on-call team, you would be the first person from that specialty to see the patient coming in. So yeah, I'm not at home being called about stuff, which would be amazing. At some point when I'm a consultant later,
years to come,
in another like 6-7 years, then I'll get to be at home and only get calls about really, really, really disastrous stuff. But
yeah,
at the moment,
big
you're just
break.
There the whole time. So I'm either doing that day shift or night shift, or I'm spending about 9, although it varies, often more hours, from like 8 till 5 in theatre, so in the operating theatre. Or
with
in
no
clinic.
Breaks?
I mean, they vary. If in theatre you have breaks in between patients whilst the anaesthetists are putting the patients to sleep. And then there's often kind of a self-administered, like half an hour for lunch kind of thing, just whenever we find the appropriate. Or we, you know, just keep going and have lunch in between patients that are being operated on. Because everything, it gets a knock-on effect as soon as you delay stuff. So, yeah, lunches and breaks are just, they just come and whenever they do.
Do you really love it?
The job?
Yeah. Do you?
Some shifts more than others. Some parts of the job more than others. But overall, yeah. It's an amazing privilege to be a part of people's lives that you just would never be a part of. Like, how many, as much as it's not the most fun part of the job, like the fact that I get to be the one that goes and tells family members that they're, you know, that has that conversation about their parent or their relative being really unwell and having and making plans and working out what's going to happen when they die and things like that. And just those kind of conversations, as much as they're really hard, they feel incredibly fulfilling because they're like, someone's got to have those conversations. Mm-hmm. And I, I think it's not a bad thing to know your strengths. And I feel like one of those, the ability to have those conversations is one of my strengths.
It's an unbelievable, it's weird. There's two such massive skills there. Obviously the job of surgery, but the people skills, and actually I always have a section.
Well, that's a learned skill. Anyone can learn to operate. The difficult part of the job is actually the communication stuff. Mm. You can do the best operation in the world, but if you haven't consented the patient properly, you haven't actually told them about what the operation is meant to do and how they are going to be in pain afterwards and how they need to really be aware of that so that they can work on it. If they're in pain afterwards, they didn't realize they were going to be in pain afterwards because no one told them. They're not going to do the exercise they need to do to get better. And so the best operation in the world is going to turn into something that didn't work.
Do you kind of get, I'm literally asking all the questions I've ever wanted to ask, get over that anxiety that most of us feel when we go into a hospital?
Oh, no, there's absolutely zero of that. It doesn't feel like a hospital to me because it's my job.
It literally feels like work.
Yeah, it's where I am. So it's what I do day by day. It's what I'm used to. It's, however, I still get a good fair amount of it if I go into a hospital and I'm not there for work. I went with a family member recently and it was all very, very strange because I said to at one point that I felt at the point in which I had to leave her was the bit in which I really realized that I didn't have any control in this situation because I was like, well, now, like, I can't just... In a normal hospital, I can go anywhere. My badge takes me anywhere. It takes me through every door. I can follow anything. I can look anything up on the computer. I can check. I can make changes to things. And this, I had zero control. Mm. And so I could be helpful in like a clinic setting if I went with her and I could talk about stuff. I could be helpful on the ward talking about stuff. But as soon as like I couldn't follow... I was then like, I am literally useless. Like, I am
is really disconcerting, isn't it?
It makes no difference I'm a doctor anymore. Like, up until then, being a doctor helped. Well, like, it was kind of helpful because I knew how the system worked and I knew what kind of questions to ask. And then at the point in which I had zero control, I was like, well, what was the point in being a doctor? Like, I can't do anything now.
Useless. But on the flip of that, do you feel weighed down by the responsibility of it, that whole, or is there a doctor on the flight thing? Does that...
That hasn't happened yet, so I'm not sure yet. But I just tend to forget about that stuff.
Do you not worry? Do people not always come to you with their medical problems, though, like your mates? Would you mind just having a look at this?
There's a mix. Like, it was... There's either people who should ask me about something and choose not to, because they're like, oh, well, I don't want to bother him because, you know, it's his job and he probably gets asked lots and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes I'm like... I wish you'd have just asked me because I could have given you really basic advice and you probably should have gone and got that checked out sooner. And do you know what I mean? And then there are people who, not as many of them, but people who will ask you about anything and everything. You're like, why are you asking me about this?
Yeah, literally, like, you can find the answer after this really quickly.
Yeah, I'm like, well, it's also like, well, it's like a lawyer being massively subspecialized. So you wouldn't ask someone who does the legal stuff about buying a house about a divorce proceeding, right? Yeah. Like, they just wouldn't know.
We're going to go on a little bit of a tangent now, I suppose. As if you didn't have one big job, you then decided to take on a kind of second career, didn't you?
It wasn't deliberate.
I know it wasn't deliberate, but this is where you ended up and you are now hugely popular. I followed you from really, really early on. What was your original handle?
It was called Unfattening.
It's all right. Mine was Peck and Mama, which is like awful. Yeah, I was actually looking back at some of your really old stuff today. Mm. It is mad to be able to document your own personal journey through social media, isn't it? You're like, oh, wow, I've come a long way.
It was weird. I mean, I started it in my second year of being a doctor. And at the time, I started feeling really uncomfortable that I was giving kind of health advice to people and I didn't stereotypically look healthy myself because I was what you would classically call overweight. And so I just felt uncomfortable. Like, I felt like I couldn't improve as a doctor unless I lost weight, which was a really strange thought process. Some of it's weird because even though I know that's not true, some of it was weirdly valid because the world is such that people would and probably did take me less seriously giving health advice because of the way that I looked, because the assumption generally is that if you're overweight, you can't be healthy, full stop. And I thought that of myself too. And so part of that was true, that actually I probably would have been listened to and respected less as a doctor. It's really shit that that's the case. But because of that and not understanding any of the nuances or anything behind it, as far as I was concerned, I was like, okay, fine. Well, I need to finally do this in the right way, whatever the in quotes, yeah, whatever the right way was. Because as I'm sure you would probably feel with me, growing up or being over a certain size that the world tells you should be, then you tend to attempt to change that on a recurrent basis. And, you know, it tends, on average, not to work very well.
So you've kind of gone on this journey of knowing that you needed to, or you feeling like you needed to lose weight.
Yeah.
And then, I know, again, from following you, then go the other way because...
Yeah, so the reason it was called unfattening is because I thought it was a cool word and it was catchy. And I was doing what 99% of Instagram accounts are, which was documenting a weight loss journey. Mm. I happened to be successful with it, but I came across a lot of things on the way that started challenging kind of the reasons and the motivations behind it and what I thought about weight loss to be true. And it was stuff that I couldn't ignore, and it was stuff I couldn't argue away or rationalize in my head. The stuff with the majority of people that diet failing, like, I kind of always knew that, but it was in my head, always just like, oh, it's just because they're not doing it properly.
No, once you start reading
and when I realized that actually that wasn't the case, it wasn't just because they weren't doing it properly, it was because of a multitude of other reasons, that I was like, okay, well, I should probably stop promoting it then. It wasn't a fun time.
Because you were healing quickly. Well, that's going to sound like a right old hippie, especially in front of a doctor, but because you were learning your relationship with food more.
Yeah, yeah.
Weren't you?
Yeah. Well, no, I used that phrase. That's fine.
I was going to say healing yourself. And then
No. Oh, yeah, I was healing my relationship with food. That's fine. You can heal a relationship.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Yeah. We all acknowledge emotional eating and all of, you know, behaviours around food, don't we?
Yeah, it's complex. And it's way more complex than just, I shouldn't keep crisps in the house and all this nonsense. And it's just, I realised that my kind of one-track mind of, you know, weight equaling health and, you know, every patient that I see, I should get them to lose weight as well. And all this kind of stuff was just really, really, really unhelpful and problematic and actually harming their health rather than benefiting them. And at this point, I'd gained a relative, in my mind, what I thought was a relatively large following on Instagram, which was, I think when I started thinking about this kind of stuff, I probably had maybe like 30,000 followers. I was like, well, now I have a responsibility to actually tell them about this stuff that I'm now coming across, because up until now, they're all following me based on these weight loss tips I'm giving them. And I don't want to be part of the problem. Now I've recognized there's a problem, then either I shut this down or I change it.
I think it's really good to have been public about that journey, because it's a huge shift, and it's diet culture and everything that goes with it is something that's so implicit to so many people that when you start going, oh no, this is a thing, it's a massive journey to unpick, isn't it? As part of this podcast, I always ask the good people of Instagram for their insight on any given topic. And actually, in relation to this particular bit, I asked them if they've ever felt judged for their weight by a doctor. And 45% had.
Only 45?
Yeah.
That's quite a good number.
Do you think?
Yeah, I would have expected it to be a lot higher than that. Just because weight is so synonymous with health as a thought process, and you're going to the doctor for health, so...
That becomes part of it. Yeah. Although I had several medical professions saying that they are duty-bound to flag it. I've previously felt more judged for my weight, you know, at any given point than how much I was drinking, and I now don't drink, or, like, not that I was ever drinking a huge amount, but it's mad that someone could admit to their alcohol intake and feel judged for...
Well, doctors drink alcohol too, so therefore in their head it's like, oh, well, it's fine, so they don't mention it as much, and then...
But you'd feel terrible for tipping the BMI scale, but... Yeah, so many people self-edit the amount of alcohol that they drink when telling their doctor.
Alcohol's a toxin. Like, it's just how much toxin can your body handle?
Yeah.
This is not as nuanced a conversation as weight and health and everything else that plays a part in that.
No.
And yet we give alcohol far more nuance than we give weight.
Shall I tell you some of their other answers about other things? I asked them how they felt about the NHS, and these were some answers. These actually made me cry earlier in the week, so I'm hoping I'm going to be better at it. Might have just got me at a bad moment, very sleep deprived. A national institution that should be protected. I'm grateful for it, but insecure about it. When it's good, it's marvellous. When it's bad, it's distressing. Mm. It's abused and will fail because too many won't take care of themselves. I'm worried about it. We are so lucky to have it. It's the very best thing in the world. They are overstretched lifesavers. It's a wonderful gift.
I'd agree with all of that, apart from the too many people won't take care of themselves statement.
Really?
Yeah, everything else. It's great.
What? Say more about that.
What? So, I mean, I'm making a judgment, but I don't know who wrote that. But I would imagine the person that wrote that is from a place of relative privilege. Like myself and like yourself. And, you know, the assumption that people are only unwell because they don't take care of themselves
is really
harmful as an assumption. There is so much privilege in health, so much impact of socioeconomics. It's unreal. The people that are the healthiest in life are the people that are the middle class, and they're the people that use the healthcare system the least. Yet they're often the people that complain the most about the healthcare system being abused by people who can't take care of themselves and just eat too much and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I would challenge that one.
Yeah.
But the rest of it, great.
I asked people if they ever avoided seeking medical help, and 60% said they did.
Yeah.
And I said, ask them why. Because resources are precious. I don't want to be a burden because I have kids and I have no opportunity to get there. Because the last few times the doctor has just Googled whilst I was in the office and printed off the results. What's your feedback on that?
Which one, the Googling
one? Yeah. But they'll just be Googling on the NHS website, won't they?
Yeah, a lot of the time. So, I mean, it's
maybe
difficult.
That's a sign of whether you should actually have been at the doctor's.
The Googling one is interesting, right? So if a lawyer wasn't allowed to use their legal books and legal documentation to help them with a case, they'd be a pretty shit lawyer. Yeah. If a doctor wasn't able to use the knowledge that is out there, the research that's out there, the anatomy books that are out there to read up on a regular basis, then they'd be a pretty shit doctor too. There are certain things that I will remind myself by Googling. The difference is that I know which ones on Google to ignore. And I know how to filter the information out. So yes, when somebody, a layperson, Googles about a condition and they come across random stuff, that's not helpful.
Yes.
But the internet is an amazing thing, and Google isn't inherently bad. It's how it's used.
Such a good answer, and something I hadn't really thought about. More answers to why they avoid seeking medical help. They don't want to hear the answer. That's not good. If you don't want to hear the answer, you should probably definitely go.
The
patient. You should probably go. Don't want to come across as needy. I mean, surely it's better to end up seeing someone who's healthy and turn them away than someone.
I'll often say, you know, I would rather you come back and us able to reassure you that actually it's fine than you not come back and us wish we'd have seen you earlier.
Exactly.
Of course, the NHS is stretched, and of course you may end up spending 4 hours in A&E just to be told it's just a cough, you'll be okay. However,
but that's a great thing.
Those times when it's not just a cough and you spend 3 weeks at home or 2 months at home and you come back and it happens to be something more sinister, then, you know, both you and I would wish that you'd have come in sooner.
Yeah. Well, I just always think you have to be hugely grateful if you get to A&E and you're not rushed through. You know, that means something that you're probably all right. Like,
111 is a really good resource to clarify. Like, that phone number, they pick up quite quickly.
We always end up on 111. But I have to say,
they err on the side of caution a lot of the time. They will often tell you if you don't need to go to A&E or go to the GP, but at least start there. Like, talk to someone.
And the last answer was, I'm a hypochondriac and 9 times out of 10, it goes away. Well, that's good. Lucky you. Questions you wish you could ask your doctor. How are you? Lots of people wanted to know how you were as a doctor. They didn't know it was you particularly, but they were caring about their doctor.
Yeah. I mean, we don't necessarily have the time to answer that question, unfortunately. That's the problem. But yeah, I mean, it's going to vary.
Yeah.
Varies day to day. Usually the answer is tired. That tends to be, I've noticed that recently. That tends to be the answer I tend to give when people are like, oh, how are you? Oh, I'm a bit tired. It's not good for my health. It's like, you need to get some more sleep. And you?
Is there training for bedside manner?
So we do communication skills training at medical school. We do. The problem is that it's a learnt skill. And some people are better at it than others. Knowing whether somebody will have good bedside manner is incredibly hard. And actually, bedside manner comes from compassion. And compassion is not a learned skill. Compassion, you can't really teach yourself. You can teach yourself to pretend to be empathetic, but real compassion is something that comes from experience, really, in my mind. There are so many people that I meet, and I'm like, you'd be such great doctors, because, like, they're just, I personally, like, communication skills and compassion are so much more important than the other.
Excellent people skills and an incredibly scientific mind aren't necessarily naturally a well-known combo, are they?
No.
And it's like, it's an interesting thing. They're very different skills.
Yeah.
Because you'll need to be someone who's buried your head in the books a lot. Doesn't mean you've got, it's interesting.
And then you spend less time talking to people if you spend all that time in
the library. Why does it take so long to be discharged?
Many reasons. Because let's say you're in A&E and you are waiting for drugs necessarily to come from pharmacy before you can leave. Mm-hmm. That will take time, because if you're able to leave, you're not as unwell as the people that can't leave. And so there's a priority list of people. And you may be lower down on that priority list because of the fact that you're more well and you're not going to die. If you're in hospital and you're waiting to be discharged, it's not just one person that has to sign you off. You've got the doctors, you've got the physios, you've got the occupational therapists, you've got the social care workers, you've got the nursing staff, you've got everyone who has to play a role in getting you to leave or be able to leave in a safe manner. And often things go wrong when people are kicked out quickly, not when people take time to leave. So there's a balance. And sometimes it's just because someone hasn't done the thing they're meant to do yet. But often that's the last reason rather than being the most common reason. There's a whole, there's lots and lots of processes. And it's one of the things that is really, really hard to truly understand until you've worked on a ward and you've realised and you see all the different things that slow things down or have to happen for things to work smoothly.
Yeah. And again, to your point,
underfund anything and it will slow down.
Yeah.
Promise.
And also, when you're waiting to be discharged, you're probably feeling well. So all of those minutes, hours, half hours, whatever, feel much bigger. Whereas for the ill person, time, but I've been before and you're literally looking at the clock because you're desperate to go, aren't you?
Yeah.
But as you say,
minutes go slowly when you're wanting to do something else.
And you're not in control. I mean, it's not, people don't like it. None of us like being out of, and you feel like you could just go over to someone and say, let me go.
I understand the feeling. I want to go home too by the end of the day.
We all want to go home. Yeah, it's funny. But that was a useful answer. People just don't know the answer to these questions, so it's good.
Yeah.
Someone said, what should I do about my anxiety? And my own personal two pence worth for this, I've got generalised anxiety disorder, and I have to say I've only ever been treated brilliantly about mental health issues by the NHS. Like, going to a GP, for you going to talk to them about mental health is just the same as going as any other illness.
Mm.
And to not feel any differently,
I think in general, the NHS, I think, has got a lot better. It doesn't mean it's perfect,
no.
But in general, I think it's got a lot better at dealing with mental health. I think people are a lot more, I think doctors in general are a lot more read up on and a lot more understanding of how important it is, and people are treated less like they used to be. There's less stigma around mental health. It's still there, but there is a lot less of it. But I mean, to answer the question, as in what should I do about my anxiety, tell someone.
Yeah.
And that can both be, you don't always need professional help, but it's not a bad thing.
No.
And from people that I've heard who have had professional help about things like that, they almost all of them unanimously say, I wish I'd have gone sooner.
Yeah.
And you can always go and then not need it.
Yeah.
That's great too.
Well, they'll give you options, won't
exactly.
they?
Exactly. So, I mean, telling people you trust, telling your friends, tell your family, as if you can trust them as well, because I know that's not always an ability for some people, and then talk to a doctor about it. And don't refuse to go just because it's going to take 12 weeks to see somebody more, see a psychiatrist about it and stuff like that, because yes, the waiting times are long, but the waiting times are going to be shorter than if you hadn't gone.
Yeah.
So there are lots of things that can be done. So doing that side of things, whilst at the same time, there's all sorts of things that we forget about, like sleep and exercise and actually spending time with people, with friends, and having relationships that often can be extra difficult because of the anxiety, but still. Mm. And often the exercise can be difficult because of the anxiety, and often the sleep can be difficult because of the anxiety. But if you are able to prioritize some of those things too, there's a good impact that they can have in combination.
And ultimately, just do not suffer in silence because, yeah, again, from personal experience, the moment you out these things, it's such a massive transition. A, to feel normalised, because you'll be surprised how many people struggle as well.
Oh, and stay off social media. The worst place for anxiety.
do not start scrolling, and no. We all know that feeling when you're like, I should be putting my phone down.
Yeah, I'm not convinced it causes anxiety, but it definitely contributes to it if you are struggling with it.
That's the thing. The times when you're doing that really bad scrolling is often when you're feeling, there'd be much better uses of your time. I asked my audience how we should save the NHS.
We know. It's too late. You lost your chance. Yeah. December's gone and passed. I don't think we really can right now. I think we have to wait and see what the wonderful world of Brexit brings.
See where we end up.
And, I'm not massively optimistic, unfortunately. I think it's not. I don't think it's ever going to look exactly the same as it once did. Because it can't. Because as long as it continues to be underfunded, people are continuing to have children. And so the population is increasing. The amount of doctors is increasing, but not in proportion to the amount of patients. Mm. And the amount of money that goes into the NHS is also increasing, but not to the proportion that it needs to be. Mm. So this whole thing of like, oh, yes, but we've increased the budget by this amount. Great. But that isn't going to cover it. It's, you know, it's like buying a bigger house and going, well, I've got this much more money for rent. It's like, yeah, but your rent is actually double now. Yeah. Oh, yeah, but it's fine because I've increased it. You're being naive. Yeah. we need more money and more doctors. Whilst that's not going to happen, and whilst that hasn't been happening over the last 15 years or however long it's been, then unfortunately the money has to come from somewhere else. You can't run a service without money. Money has to be found from somewhere. And so that's the reason why parts of the NHS have been sold to private companies, because they needed the money in the short term.
Yeah.
And that's a problem that has been created by the government. So it's an issue. But yeah, you can't really buy those back, because again, to buy them back, you have to have a surplus of money. Which, and that's never going to happen.
No, so that's gone.
You know, those services, like going, and I'm sure people will know of times when they've been sent to go and have an x-ray in a private clinic, for example, rather than in a hospital, because the private clinic has a deal with their local GP, and so they get their chest x-ray there, or they have their blood test done privately, or, you know, they're now using private hospitals to have NHS operations, for example, now. You know, all this kind of stuff is only going to continue and get more and more. I know that's a bit of a bummer question.
And what does the future look like for you? How are you going to continue to do this juggle between...
With great skill and dexterity.
I'm being tired.
I'm not planning on stopping anytime soon.
In closing, I suppose, what would your alternative career have been? What would you have been if you weren't a doctor or a social media person?
Well, before I wanted to be a doctor, my first job role that I thought I was going to do was I was going to be chess champion of the world, because I was really cool as a kid. And then it was like a toss-up between being a chef and being a rock star.
I mean, it's quite a broad spectrum.
I know, right? Yeah. I think it would have to be something, if it was reliable, something to do with music or something to do with cooking. I know that's two different things, but yeah.
But it's really nice to be able to get into some of the little nitty-gritty stuff that you just don't even have the opportunity to ask. And often you only presented a certain version of it, either on television or when you go into a hospital yourself when you're irrational. So thank you. It's been very informative. And thank you for doing an amazing superhuman job.
That's all right.
Now we're going to get to the bit in a minute that you're meant to be thinking about in the back of your head. First of all, where can people find you? And is there anything you want to shout about?
If you type in Dr. Joshua, just Dr. Joshua, then I should come up.
That's
on
good.
Instagram. And if you type in my name, my full name on Apple Podcasts and things, you'll get all sorts of podcasts I've been on. So that'll be fun.
And then the Honest Confessions that I mentioned to you at the beginning. So these are some of other people's ones, and then you can do yours in a
just
minute.
Just so I can tell whether mine's good enough.
Yeah.
Right?
So I asked them to complete the sentence. I'll be honest, I fancy a shag. Fucking hate going to the park. That is definitely written by a parent. I've met my soulmate already, but it's not the man I'm married to.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, that was, I was like, wow. I'll be honest, I think the NHS is over. I really need a poo. Hate the fact that my dad is a Brexiteer. Yeah. I'm phobic of cold egg, but don't mind it hot. Have severe anxiety, but don't want to waste the doctor's time. You definitely won't be wasting the doctor's time. You should definitely go. And then what's your honest confession?
I mean, I thought of one and then I keep trying to think of a different one. So I'm assuming I have to think of go with the first one.
Yeah.
Used to steal from the local corner shop as a kid.
What did you steal?
Tubs of Pringles.
I mean, they are hot property.
Part of me is quite impressed that I managed to get, like, the big tubs, not the little ones.
The little ones?
Yeah, exactly. Part of me is relatively impressed that I managed to do that and never get caught. And part of me is obviously ashamed.
Horrified. Where did you up your coat?
Off the into like a rucksack. I don't know how I did it. I didn't practice at home. I don't know how I managed to do this. But yeah, it was for good reason.
But you really wanted Pringles.
No, I was... Look, see, now you're going to feel bad for mocking me.
Okay. Go on then.
No, so I mentioned earlier that my dad's an alcoholic.
Yeah.
So there would be times when he would like think he'd fed us as kids.
And
be like, all right, bedtime. And be like, but and if we said we hadn't had food, we'd get in trouble, right? So it would then be like, I'd get to the point where I'd be like, well, I need to make sure that I eat before I go home. So it was on the way home from school. Or, you know, have a stash of food in my bedroom.
Right.
That was an interest. I mean, you know, the whole relationship with food thing. It's some of why I understand some of this stuff. Some of why I have some of this compassion about this stuff. That even though I come from a place of privilege, there are still parts of my life that I remember that impacted my relationship with food.
Mine is, I'll be honest, I have really shifted my relationship with food and dieting, thanks to Laura and a lot of other things. But I still have to repeatedly remind myself that on Mondays, because you go to start that diet again, and you're like, oh no, I don't do that anymore. Same after Christmas, same before holidays. But what a relief it is to be over that particular phase of my life.
Yeah.
So that's that. That feels like quite a nice round ending, which is good.
Yeah.
I've been Clemmy Telford, and this lovely gentleman has been Dr. Joshua. and this has been Honestly. Thank you for listening. Please rate, review, subscribe, and tell your mates all about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Honestly. If you found this week's episode interesting, which I hope you did, I'd love to know your thoughts. So please do give me a rating or review, and even better, hit the subscribe button. That way you'll get each week's episode delivered straight to you.